On this week's 51%, we hear about women-directed films at the upcoming Woodstock Film Festival. We'll meet a woman who is a deputy fire chief.
I use more of my legs when I have to lift something. I do have upper body strength, but I just need to do it differently than the guys do it. And I can still get it done and still get it done just as quickly.
And see how VA medical centers fare when it comes to providing services for women. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. It's fall, so it must be film festival season, at least in certain parts. One such festival at this time of year is the Woodstock Film Festival, which screens independent films not only in Woodstock, New York, but in nearby Rhinebeck, Rosendale, Saugerties, and Kingston. The fiercely independent 17th annual Woodstock Film Festival features 44 female directors who will present their works. That's one-third of the festival's offerings, including the North American premiere of Betty Gordon's The Drowning. I spoke with Mira Blaustein, the festival's co-founder and executive director.
As more and more women are becoming more supportive of each other and really trying to elevate the whole workspace for all of them, film festivals such as the Woodstock Film Festival, which is all about supporting the independent filmmaker and giving them a voice, to those who have who really work hard to present, to create and present quality filmmaking. So we make it a point to give those people a voice and a platform. And if we can give more room in our programming for women filmmakers out there in the field, you know, we're thrilled to be doing that.
Mira, I do want you to talk about the women-directed films at your film festival. But first, you're very tuned into film festivals around the world. Are you seeing that what happens at Woodstock in terms of including women-made films is what's happening at other film festivals, or are you alone in this?
Well, there is a definite effort being made. Whether it's successful or not, that's a whole different story. But if you look at all the major film festivals out there, whether it's Toronto or Cannes, there's always a very specific mention as to how many films there are made by women filmmakers. It still pales in comparison to the number of films made by men, I have to admit. So Woodstock is a bit of a pioneer in that arena, but there is, across the board, there's a definite consensus that things need to be different. And everyone is aware that they need to make a change, and that includes the programmers of all film festivals, the big ones and the not so big.
So talk about what's going on this year at the Woodstock Film Festival in terms of women.
Well, it happens to have quite a bit of a presence of women filmmakers in the festival this year. I'm really quite thrilled. Just looking, even before you look at the films and you look at the panels, at the festival, we have 8 panel discussions in the festival. 3 of them are all about women, which is really a first for us. Years ago, we have established a panel that is strictly spotlights the works of women filmmakers, and we certainly are doing that this year. In addition to that, we have a panel this year that shines a light specifically on the situation of women in the Middle East and where they are now in terms of equality and where it's going. And that stems directly from a specific film that we're showing at the festival. In addition to that, we have Katherine Hardwick, who is an amazing woman director. She, among many things, she's the creator of the Twilight series, which was a mega hit. So she's here going, and she will be giving a master class. So it's not going to be specific woman-related, but as a woman director who has made it in a field that's still difficult for women to make it, she will have a great experience to share with the audience there. So I'm really happy about the panel portion of the festival, and as it relates specifically to women, even though generally speaking the panels are all just great and people should just come and see all of them.
Of course they should, Mira. Listen, I really would love to hear more about this panel on women in the Middle East and the film with which it's affiliated.
Absolutely. It's an incredible film. It's called The Promised Band. And The Promised Band is made by a woman director. Her name is Jen Hack. She lives and works in New York City, but she has traveled to the Middle East, and she was very compelled to bridge women from Israel and Palestine, and she found it almost impossible to be doing that because of border issues. So she and those women who really wanted to get to know each other created a make-believe band, and they called it the Promise Band. And with that excuse to having to practice together, they were able to move somewhat more easily across borders between Israel to Palestine and vice versa. It's just such a wonderful film, and you really get to know them as individuals and their differences, and they become very close friends through the making of the film. And these women, by the way, are attending the festival with the film, the Palestinian women's and the Israeli women's. And having that film started that whole panel that I mentioned to you. And by the way, I worked very closely with the filmmaker to put that festival, that panel together. So the panel is called Insiders and Outsiders in the Middle East. And it's really all about, you know, where feminism currently in the Middle East, where it's at. Obviously not necessarily in the best of places, but is there progress being made? If so, what kind of progress? What are the obstacles? How do we get through the obstacles? So there's going to be a very frank conversation by women, female artists, academics. We have a couple of professors and activists, including the two activists from the film, the Israeli and the Palestinian one, and the filmmaker herself. She will participate as well. The panel is going to be quite fully encompassing, bringing people from different sides, from the activists to the academics to the creatives. And they're all going to have a very frank conversation examining the situation and seeing where things can go from now and how.
I do want to get to trends that you see in women in filmmaking. But first, why don't you talk about some of the other women-directed films at the festival?
One of them is the world premiere of Betty Gordon's new film. Betty Gordon did Handsome Harry with Steve Buscemi and people like that. And the film that she's bringing to the festival this year is called The Drowning. And it's really intense and extremely well done film, and she's going to be here. The cast is going to be here. Specifically, Josh Charles, the actor, is going to be here with the film as well. And Betty is going to participate also in the women directors panel. So I'm very happy to have her here with the film. And another film of note that I wanted to bring up, which is it's a tiny film again. It's going to have its world premiere at the Woodstock Film Festival, and it's a documentary called Women of Maidan. And the Women of Maidan has such an amazing backstory behind it. It's by this filmmaker, a Ukrainian filmmaker, living and working in Bethesda, Maryland, and she received this call years back from her mother, who was crying on the phone and saying that the women at the square in Maidan are being hurt, and that there was the beginning of a revolution starting there, and you know the women there were in the forefront. So the filmmaker just dropped everything, went back to Ukraine, and flung herself into the midst of the revolution, and documented that amazing uprising where the women, you know, grandmothers, mothers, daughters, all put themselves in harm's way to try and make a change in the Ukraine. So that film is so emotional and so incredibly authentic because she's right there with it, and she's part of it, and she... I think it changed her life to go and make that film, and she's bringing it to us for the first time, and I'm really thrilled. And she's, of course, attending, and she's going to be speaking on one of the panels, by the way, but a different panel that has to do with documentaries and storytelling. It's almost the opposite of The Drowning in terms of you have this very accomplished independent filmmakers, Betty Gordon, who's coming with stars and really strong film, and you have this other young filmmaker who's threw her, almost her life away to put, to bring to our lives something that she was willing to risk so much for and was just so passionate about, and it's a very strong story. So it's interesting, the cross-section of women in the film world that are out there working and some of those who are attending at the Woodstock Film Festival with their works.
Wow, just fascinating as always, Mira. Listen, I do want to get your feeling on trends now with women in film. Are you seeing more women in a particular genre? Are you seeing them in certain careers within filmmaking? Are there more directors? Are there more producers? You know, that kind of thing.
So there's certainly more women of color who are getting ahead, getting themselves ahead within the entertainment industry and specifically the film industry. And that's very reassuring to see, even though, of course, we all know that there's still a lot to be gained before we can say, oh, there's no such thing as gender inequality. We're all just doing what we're doing, and we're doing it well. And as far as just women in general working in the film industry, the independent film world has always played by different rules than the Hollywood and commercial world. So I think the statistics are growing within the independent film world, while in Hollywood it's still quite a challenge to change the, you know, the single-digit numbers there. But for women directors, as it has been happening in the past few years, there are more and more women in the documentary film world who are working and making a difference and creating amazing, bringing amazing stories to light. In the narrative arena, the numbers are growing, but in a slower pace, because there are more and more organizations that are supporting women narrative directors. There are specific organizations such as this one called Game Changer. The other is, I'm blanking on the name, Tangerine Entertainment. I mean, these are funding organizations. These are organizations that seek out women directors and seek to produce their films. That is key, because you have to, somebody has to greenlight a filmmaker. Somebody has to fund a film. So if you have more and more companies, producers, organizations, funders who are there to encourage films, filmmaking by women, and who are there to fund them, the numbers of women filmmakers will grow. It's very simple math. So there are more and more of these companies and organizations. And one of the films that we are showing at the festival, for instance, it's called Painted Black. It's by Amber Tamblyn, who is a very well-known, wonderful actress and also a poet. This is her first film, and it's a great film. And it was produced and funded by Tangerine Entertainment, which is a company that was created by women, and their mission is to fund and produce films by high-quality women directors. So that kind of a trend is happening, and we need to see that grow and grow, because then you'll have more women directors such as Betty Gordon or such as Amber Tamblyn being able to make films and make good films, of course.
That was Mira Blaustein, co-founder and executive director of the Woodstock Film Festival, which features more than 130 films, panels, and events from October 13th through October 16th. We'll now head a bit north of Woodstock to Albany, New York, and hear about another field where women are even fewer. Captain Maria Walker recently was promoted to deputy chief, the highest rank ever held by a woman in the Albany Fire Department. She is a third-generation firefighter, following her grandfather and her father, who both served as firefighters in the Buffalo Fire Department. Walker recently sat down with 51%'s Dave Lucas to discuss her new rank.
There are three women right now in a 260-member Albany Fire Department, of which you are one. Whatever possessed you to try your hand at firefighting?
I have to be perfectly honest, I was headed to law school. I was in college, and my father said to me, "You're old enough, your brother's taken the test, you take the test." So it was really at my father's urging that I took the test. And he said, "You know, if you want to be hired to be a firefighter, you need to be an EMT, emergency medical technician." He goes, "Even if you don't take the job, that's a good life skill, how to handle yourself in an emergency. Go get the class." And I said, "Okay." You know, I was 19, still doing what my father wants me to do. And the letter came that the fire department was interested in hiring me. And my father said to me, "Give it a shot. You can always quit."
And you did.
And here I am.
Any regrets about having not followed your original path?
None. I have the best job in the world. I just didn't know it at 19 that it would be.
Is firefighting in your blood? Does your family have a history of public service in this vein?
My father and my grandfather were both members of the Buffalo Fire Department. But I have 8 siblings and I'm the only one that does this.
Well, give us an idea of the timeline here.
I was the 4th female hired in October of 1989. I became a lieutenant in, I believe it was December of 2006. I was promoted to captain in November of 2011 and just promoted to deputy chief a couple weeks ago.
How do you account for your rise through the ranks?
The promotion to lieutenant and captain is done by civil service exam. I did well on the lieutenant's test, and I'll be honest, I did okay on the captain's exam, but they were able to reach me through the process of the civil service requirements. I was quite surprised when the chief asked me for the resume and honored.
So here you are, settling in. What's your day like right now?
I work mostly with the training division and the captain that works in that office. Training the firefighters, training the EMTs, training the paramedics, making sure the recertifications are kept up. The EMS supplies for the department, firefighting supplies, all the things that go along with training. That's where I am right now.
Do you ever get a chance to go out in the community and pitch firefighting to school kids?
Over the years, I've been asked to come to schools and speak to usually middle school girls about staying in programs with math and science. It's hard to speak for somebody else, but the one thing that I've experienced over the years is the girls will say to me, "Well, I couldn't do that," or "I can't run into a fire." But I tell them, you can do it. You just have to do it a little differently. I use more of my legs when I have to lift something. I do have upper body strength, but I just need to do it differently than the guys do it. And I can still get it done and still get it done just as quickly.
What would a girl who has an interest in firefighting do to get in line for what could be a career?
Each department has different requirements, but to join the Albany Fire Department, you need a high school diploma, a driver's license, and an emergency medical technician card. You need to be a New York State EMT. You can get an EMT card in many places around the state. And it takes about 6 months to do that, roughly, depending on how the classes run. And then you take a civil service exam.
Now, I read where another female firefighter recently joined the ranks of the AFD.
Erin Engstrom was just hired in January, and she was the first female to pass the, we call it the CPAT, or Candidate Physical Agility Test, in Albany. I believe there's been at least one other woman that has passed since Erin did. But Erin was the first female hired in almost 18 years, due to that requirement. We had women who came very close and didn't quite get past the physical test.
How were you able to juggle between family life and working for the Albany Fire Department?
I found it to be a great job, especially when my son was young, due to the schedule that we work in the firehouse. It's one 24-hour day on with 72 hours off. So at the end of the week, we work a 40-hour week like everyone else. But with the 3 days off, it gave me an opportunity to be a homeroom mom, to go on every field trip he had in elementary school, probably much to his dismay. But it gave me a lot of time to spend with my son. So in that way, it was a fantastic job. I did have somebody say to me once, "Well, when you go to work, you could die." And I said, "And you could step off the curb and get hit by a bus." As there are safety measures that we take, we're trained to do our jobs. And do accidents happen? Absolutely. But it could happen to me anywhere else. So I find it to be a great job for a working parent.
That was 51%'s Dave Lucas speaking with Deputy Chief Maria Walker of the Albany Fire Department. Her rank is the highest ever held by a woman in that department. The percentage of women veterans has more than quadrupled in the last 40 years, and the Department of Veterans Affairs is struggling to keep up. VA medical centers often lack services for female veterans, and some women say they feel unwelcome or invisible there. John Ismay reports.
Maggie Castillo Torres served in the Navy for 8 years, but when she first walked into a VA hospital in San Diego, she heard,
"Are you here with your spouse? Are you the spouse of a veteran?"
Did that happen just once, or?
No, it's happened several times.
Things didn't get much better once she got an appointment.
The doctors there, they really didn't relate to the kind of experience I had. And so I really got offended and humiliated, and I decided not to even deal with the VA for a while.
That was back in 2010. 3 years later, Castillo Torres decided to try again, this time at the VA hospital in Westwood.
Are they taking good care of you now?
Yes, they are. Now they are.
Castillo Torres, like a lot of other veterans, is entitled to free health care at the VA. When the first veterans hospitals opened in the 1920s, there just weren't a lot of women serving compared to men. Since 9/11, the number of women enrolled in VA care has almost tripled to 675,000 today. That's left the VA struggling to catch up.
The VA was built for men, and we've been working very hard to build in all the things that women need.
That's Dr. Patty Hayes. She's the chief consultant for Women Veterans Health at the VA in Washington, D.C. Hayes started working in VA healthcare in the mid-1980s.
There were very small numbers of women that were being seen in the VA medical centers, but the care wasn't really very good.
She says female vets were mainly an afterthought.
Often they were sent off to the side, or they were admitted. They didn't have bathrooms for them. All kinds of things were going on.
Now there are bathrooms for women, but the VA lacks some services for female vets, like maternity wards and certain fertility treatments. There's gender sensitivity training for employees, and nationwide, at least 90% of all clinics have at least one provider specially trained in women's care. One example of progress is this women's clinic at the Greater Los Angeles VA Hospital in Westwood. It's the nation's largest veterans healthcare facility, and on a recent Wednesday, patients filled the women's clinic waiting room.
We call it one-stop shop.
Dr. Fatma Batuman runs the clinic.
They can have their mental health care, their primary care. They can have their gender-specific care. If they need procedures by gynecologists, that's also taken care of.
Batuman oversees a staff of about 30 full-time employees, including 8 primary care doctors, 4 gynecologists, a nutritionist, and a pharmacist. All the providers here are women. Batuman says the clinic was created in response to the growing population of female vets and to give women a place where they feel safe in a place that's otherwise overwhelmingly male. It's a big change from when Dr. Batuman got here 10 years ago.
When I first came, this clinic was only 2 half-a-days per week, and the rest of the time it was used by other subspecialties.
Now it's a full-time women's clinic, open 5 days a week, and serves about 10,000 patients. Ramona Yates is here to see her doctor. She gave birth just a month ago to her daughter, Naya. The VA hospital doesn't have a maternity ward, so she went to UCLA's hospital just a couple miles away.
They treated me really well over there. My only complaint was that I had to have a C-section, but other than that, they treated me really good.
As the average patient age has gone down, VA officials say they're seeing more and more female vets who are having children. The VA pays for the birth, and Yates says the program worked well for her. Now she's going back to her regular VA doctor. She says this clinic is a safe space. And she says people on the outside often don't believe her when she tells them she was a Marine.
They don't, especially if you got my voice. They don't.
That's the reality for women veterans.
The best way to describe it is invisible.
As more and more women serve on active duty and in combat, that invisibility is something the VA is working to fix for women returning home. I'm John Ismay reporting.
And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1419.